Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Millions of people voted in the Philippines presidential election on Monday. Nearly complete, unofficial results show that Rodrigo Duterte won the most votes, the Associated Press reported. Duterte is the long-serving mayor of the city of Davao. He was leading in public opinion surveys by as much as 10 percentage points over his closest competitors, Senator Grace Poe and Interior Secretary Manuel Rakas. Rakas had the support of current President Benigno Aquino, who is leaving office. Voter turnout was expected to be close to 80% in the election. Duterte is 71 years old. He has gained support with his sometimes offensive speeches, in which he made promises to fight crime and corruption and to execute criminals. With his offensive language and open discussion of sexual activity, he has drawn comparisons to U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump. Senator Poe was another key candidate. She is 47 years old. Her campaign slogan was "Government with a Heart." As she cast her vote at a Manila area elementary school Monday, she was surrounded by supporters and members of the media. She told the media she offered her choice to God, her father, and her countrymen. Poe's father was the local action film star Fernando Poe Jr. He ran for president in 2004 and narrowly lost.
Outside of the Manila school, retiree Freddie Flores said he voted for Poe. Flores said his main concern for the Philippines was the dispute with China over territory in the South China Sea. For the security of the country, of course, it's better if you can blend well and have diplomacy. You can't just be tough, he said. Flores said he worried about his children's future. He feared Duterte, with his tough talk, could cause the Philippines to be wiped out by China. Duterte has said that as president, he would ride a jet ski to the Scarborough Shoal. The area is part of the contested territory in the South China Sea. Duterte told voters he would plant a Philippine flag and expect to die a hero at the hands of the Chinese. Current Vice President Jejomar Binay was also among the top four presidential candidates. Ferdinand Marcos Jr., son of the former Filipino dictator, is a candidate in the race for vice president. He has led in public opinion surveys against five other candidates. Boxing star Manny Pacquiao is a candidate for the Senate.
Officials have reported delays in voting because of technical difficulties. Some officials have reported that electronic voting machines were not working correctly. The Commission on Elections announced it would extend voting by 1 hour because of the problems. The military of the Philippines said it has witnessed shootings, explosions, and other violent acts. The violence has resulted in 10 deaths and 3 injuries in western Mindanao, the central Philippines, and Luzon Island.
An election poll monitoring group, supported by the Roman Catholic Church, said it told volunteers in some provinces to leave. Those volunteers left for their safety after they observed cheating. Ramon Cacipe is the executive director of the Manila-based Institute for Political and Electoral Reform. He said this election may be having more problems because of the high number of registered voters. Nearly 54 million citizens of the Philippines have registered to vote.
Cacipe said he is trying to determine whether or not stories of election cheating are widespread. He called the races for top offices hotly contested. He said that if the process is compromised by cheating, that would mean the failure of democracy.
North Korea has expelled a team of BBC reporters. The reporters were ordered to leave the country as it held a rare gathering of its Workers' Party Congress, led by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Mario Ritter brings us this story.
North Korea has expelled a group of BBC reporters, apparently because the country was unhappy with their reports. The BBC's Tokyo correspondent, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, was detained Friday. His cameraman and producer were also detained as the group was about to leave North Korea. The BBC reported that Wingfield Hayes was interrogated by North Korean officials for 8 hours and made to sign a statement. The team remained in Pyongyang before flying to Beijing on Monday. The BBC reporters were in North Korea before the Workers' Party Congress meeting in Pyongyang. They were also following a delegation of Nobel Prize winners who were visiting the country. The team later joined about 130 other foreign reporters covering the Workers' Party Congress. The event is the biggest political convention to be held in North Korea in 36 years. But the reporters covering the Congress were kept away from party officials attending the meeting. The reporters also were closely monitored by North Korean representatives. The Party Congress has tried to show unity and support for the policies of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Among those policies are development of both the economy and nuclear weapons. During the Congress, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un declared his country was a nuclear state. However, he said, North Korea would not use nuclear weapons unless its sovereignty is violated. Kim said he is willing to consider normalizing ties with countries that have been hostile to North Korea in the past. Experts said the North Korean leader did not offer any serious new proposals for reducing international tensions over the country's nuclear program. South Korea's defense ministry rejected Kim's assertion that North Korea is a nuclear power. "It is a consistent position of us and the international community that we do not recognize North Korea as a nuclear state," said a defense ministry spokesman. He said that South Korea will continue to push efforts to make North Korea give up its nuclear program through sanctions and pressure. The United Nations placed strong new sanctions on North Korea in March for its latest nuclear test in January and a rocket launch earlier this year. Korea expert Bruce Bennett from the RAND Corporation, told VOA, the North does not need nuclear weapons for its defense. Bennett pointed out that North Korea did not have nuclear weapons for many years after the end of the Korean War in 1953. He said during that time it was not attacked by the United States. He also warned that once North Korea starts with a small number of nuclear weapons, that number could keep growing.
If they have more than a few, they're not purely defensive. They're starting to field an offensive capability. And that's bad news for North Korea because they may eventually push the U.S. to do something about it.
Bennett added that North Korea lacks credibility on the nuclear issue because it has broken agreements and shared nuclear technology with other countries. Another expert, Bong Yong-shik, from the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul, doubts the commitment made by Kim Jong-un at the Congress.
I think the proposal needs to be weighted to see whether it carries any real significance, or it's just a cover-up for the sake of proposing to the world that North Korean regime might be interested in, you know, a reduction of tension.
I'm Mario Ritter.
The United States is expressing concern about the rising political unrest in Iraq. The Obama administration is concerned about how the unrest will affect the fight against the self-declared Islamic State group. Recently, protesters raided the Green Zone in Baghdad. The Green Zone is the protected area of Iraq's capital where foreigners live and work. Sheikh Sabah took part in the protests. "This is what we want," he said. "If there are no reforms, the whole government should be replaced." Shiite clergyman Muqtada al-Sadr sent the protesters to the Green Zone to pressure the Iraqi government. The government, led by another Shiite, Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi. This is just one example of divisions within the country. James Jeffrey served as the U.S. ambassador to Iraq under President Barack Obama. He says from the U.S. position, there is probably about a 60% chance that Iraq will stabilize at what he calls the same level of dysfunctionality. The United States has supported Abadi's effort to build a central government across different religious groups. The hope is that a stronger government will help Iraqi and local forces beat back Islamic State forces. But with the rising disorder and trouble, President Obama is urging the Iraqi government to move quickly.
It's up to the Iraqi people to determine the government that they form. We do think, however, that it is vital for the health and stability of Iraq that the cabinet and the makeup of the government is finalized and stabilized, and we've been urging them to get the job done.
With a weak government, Jeffrey says, U.S. officials should not depend on the Iraqi government to successfully face the militant group. That is, unless Washington is willing to do more militarily. Jeffrey says the U.S. should continue fighting against the IS militants. He adds, if the Iraqi government falls apart, then there are other groups like the Kurds and local Sunni tribes, which the U.S. military can turn to and train.
The Iraqi army and local forces have made gains in recent months with the help of U.S. airstrikes and military trainers. But the growing U.S. military presence comes at a cost. A member of the U.S. Armed Forces was killed Tuesday near the city of Mosul. He was part of a U.S. military effort to help Christian and Kurdish fighters against IS forces. The Obama administration has predicted that Iraq and local forces backed by the coalition will recapture Mosul by the end of the year. But observers say the political unrest will not help in the fight to defeat the extremists. While IS has lost about 40% of the territory it once held in Iraq, it still keeps control of large areas. I'm Ann Ball.
Concussions are a common injury in contact sports. A blood test performed soon after the injury can help doctors know if someone has suffered a concussion. Christopher Jones-Cruz has this report.
A new blood test can tell doctors whether a person has suffered a concussion up to a week after he or she was injured. A study describing the test was published in the journal JAMA Neurology. People who suffer a head injury should rest soon after they are hurt. Doctors say rest is important in helping the brain to heal after the injury. Individuals who have suffered a concussion do not always show symptoms. Experts say those warning signs can be delayed, especially in children. A concussion can lead to a feeling of dizziness, headaches, and an inability to sleep. These problems can exist for a long time. Some concussion patients have experienced loss of memory, trouble thinking, and feelings of anxiety. Doctors at Orlando Health System in Florida developed the new blood test. It shows if a biomarker is present in a person's blood. The biomarker is called glial fibrillary acidic protein, or GFAP. The protein is only found in the brain and nervous system after a person suffers a concussion. Researchers examined the blood of 600 patients. They found the biomarker in the blood of those who had suffered a head injury. Concussion is a common injury in contact sports. A blood test soon after a head injury could show if an athlete has suffered a concussion. Without the test, sports team officials may not know whether the player has a concussion and may return him or her to the game. I'm Christopher Jones-Cruz.
This is what's trending today. Sadiq Khan is the new mayor of London. Khan is the son of Pakistani immigrants. He is the first Muslim elected as mayor of a major Western capital. In his acceptance speech, Khan said he never dreamed someone like him could be elected mayor of London. After his election, Khan received a number of congratulations on social media. One came from American Hillary Clinton, who is seeking the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Clinton wrote, "Son of a Pakistani bus driver, champion of workers' rights and human rights, and now mayor of London. Congrats. Actor William Shatner also sent a message of congratulations. He did it in a way related to his part as Captain Kirk in the 1960s television show Star Trek. The TV series led to a number of Star Trek movies, including one called The Wrath of Khan. William Shatner's message to Sadiq Khan read, "Khan! Congratulations, Mr. Mayor." In one of his first official acts, Khan attended a memorial ceremony at a sports center in North London. He joined thousands of Jews there on Sunday to remember victims of the Holocaust during World War II. Khan had a big day Monday, his first full day as mayor. He made his first tweet from the @mayorofLondon Twitter handle. "I'm having a fantastic first day on the job as your new mayor," he wrote. And that's what's trending today. I'm Dan Friedel.
American Douglas Lindsay left prison last November after 19 years and 28 days. He had been given a life prison sentence for selling the drug crack cocaine. President Barack Obama reduced his sentence last year. Lindsay is one of 306 people who had sentences for nonviolent crimes reduced by the president, who calls the United States a nation of second chances. Lindsay told VOA he knows many former prisoners have a hard time finding work after their release. "I was lucky," he said. Lindsay's younger brother helped him get a job at a local pasta producer near his brother's North Carolina home. He now loads big boxes of pasta for shipment to stores. Douglas Lindsay was 28 when he was sentenced and 47 when he left prison. At the time of his arrest, he had completed a college study program. He was hoping to marry and have children. "I had all the dreams of a young man: marriage, children, a good job, and that house with the white picket fence," he said. Lindsay said he got his lifetime sentence when others arrested with him claimed he was their leader. "That wasn't true," Lindsay said. "He was a nobody in terms of drug sales," Lindsay said. "But those who said he was a bigger player received short jail terms and got Lindsay the longest possible sentence, life." "No, I'm not bitter," Lindsay said. "What is the biggest change since he went to prison?" "Technology," he said. "There were no smartphones in 1997. Now, everyone is spending all their time looking down at their phones," he said. The criminal justice system, which Lindsay recently left, is now the center of a major reform effort. The U.S. Congress is considering bills to reduce required long prison sentences for nonviolent crimes, mostly for selling drugs. The required sentences were set by federal laws passed in the 1980s and 1990s. President Obama stopped the federal government from asking people seeking government jobs if they were ever jailed for a crime. Now that question can only be asked when the government is ready to make a job offer. Last month, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe signed an order giving voting rights to over 200,000 ex-prisoners. That leaves only three U.S. states that block most ex-prisoners from voting. Obama explained the current changes this way. Now, plenty of people should be behind bars, he said, but the reason we have so many more people in prison than any other developed country is not because we have more criminals. It's because we have criminal justice policies, including unfair sentencing laws, that need to be reformed. According to the U.S. Justice Department, over 2.2 million people are held in federal, state, and local prisons. About 650,000 people are released from prison every year. Most need jobs. In 1988, Marshall Shackelford needed a job. He had been in prison since 1984. When he got out, he took over care of his two children, ages 4 and 7. Shackelford found a warehouse job at Mays Chemical in Indiana. That job was just so important to me, he said. I had to take care of my children. Over the years, Shackelford worked his way up to warehouse supervisor, and Mays Chemical continues to employ ex-prisoners. Shackelford said Mays asked people with a criminal history to find a person respected in the community to speak up for them. This does two things, he said. It makes them develop a relationship with someone who is respected in the community and to live up to the recommendation that they got for the job. He said ex-prisoners working at Mays have done as well or better than other employees. Michael Santos was released from prison in 2013 after serving 25 years for selling cocaine. It would be hard enough, he said, for people released from prison to find jobs, even if there was no discrimination. People returning after long sentences in prison find their friends and family back home have moved on, and they come home often without any money and without the skills needed in today's job market, Santos said. Santos now heads a business helping people entering and returning from prison. Molly Gill is with a group called Families Against Mandatory Minimums. She said, reducing sentences for nonviolent offenders has won support from both conservatives and liberals because it saves money and it is the fair thing to do. But she wishes a bill under consideration in the U.S. Senate would do more to reduce sentences for nonviolent crimes. As she notes, those coming home after long sentences have the hardest time finding jobs. The National Center for Victims of Crime said it is important the damage done to victims and their families not be left out of reform efforts. Victims' rights must be at the core of all reforms, the group said in a statement. Deva Pager teaches sociology at Harvard University in Massachusetts. She has looked at the problems facing people after they are released from prison. In one study, she had people apply for jobs, all with the same experience, except some said they had been convicted of a crime. Those that listed past crimes got called back only half as much as those who did not list past crimes. In another study, Pager looked at promotions for people who entered the U.S. military. She found people who had criminal records moved quicker to better-paying positions than those who did not. In her opinion, the military did a good job making sure those with criminal records could handle military service. And Pager said it is possible people who serve time work harder, grateful someone gave them a chance, and not ever wanting to return to prison. I'm Bruce Alpert.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.